Well, I guess we're going to get started here. Our guest today is Ernie Carpenter. Ernie lives down in Braxton County and a little further south and a little bit west of here, about maybe 60 or 70 miles. And I'd like to try to keep these sessions pretty informal. If people have questions for Ernie, we'll hear a lot of his music. And if you have any questions as we go along, please speak up. I'm sure Ernie will only be too glad to answer what questions he can. And I think we're going to start off. You said you'd start off with You Piney Mountain.
If you want that, yeah. Okay. This is an old tune. It's been played for 200 years, maybe or more. It goes back to my grandparents, way back. My hand's sweaty. If I miss any notes, well, you'll have to make allowance.
I know there's a lot of people here, and it may be pretty hard to hear in the back. You know, there's a lot of space up front here on the floor. If anybody's into that, just come on up and crowd in. Ernie, can you tell the folks anything about that tune?
That tune is the tune of my great-great-grandfather wrote back years ago. He lived in a country where it was a thickets of tall pine, and I guess he thought that part of the country was fitting for the name of the tune, and that's what he named it, Piney Mountain. And it's been, well, everybody that hears it, of course, likes it, and it's been played down through the years, and will be played, I hope, from now on by fiddlers as they come on, and younger fiddlers will learn it and keep playing it, because it's an awful good tune and an awful old tune. And I play a tune that my father wrote that he called Flippin' Jenny. It's another tune that is played a lot back around in our area, back in our part of the country. And it's a pretty good old tune, and I'll play a little of it.
want to tell them the story with that tune, Ernie? That's got a little story to it, doesn't it?
That's a tune my father wrote. He had a girl that was kind of a hard somebody to get along with, and he wrote that tune and named it after her. And do you want me to tell him about the squirrels?
Sure.
She loved squirrel meat, so she wanted me to go kill her a mess of squirrels. And he said, I'm busy working. I ain't got time to kill you a mess of squirrels. She kept on insisting he'd kill her a mess of squirrels. So he got up one morning to get rid of her early and took his gun, run out, and gone about an hour and brought her back some squirrels and cleaned them up and took them to her. But I'm getting ahead of my story again on that. She told him before he went to kill the squirrels, she said, if you'll go get me a mess of squirrels, I'll give you something better than a squirrel. So he went and got the squirrels. And it went on for some time, and he told her one night, he said, say, what about our deal we had? She said, I come up with my part of it. What about you? She said, you know, Shelt, since I eat those squirrels, I have decided that there isn't anything better than squirrels. Here's an old tune that my great-grandfather wrote. He was born under a rock back in Indian days. And when he was a young man, he started sawing around on the fiddle, and he was sawing on this tune. And his dad asked him what it was, and he said he was going to call it the Shelvin Rock. That was the Shelvin Rock that he was born under. On my record, that picture of me, if you've been there, you saw mine and Gary's record, where I'm playing the fiddle standing under that rock. It's on my record, mine and Gary's record. And I'll play this tune, Shelvin Rock.
Your grandfather made that tune, and you, after he was born under that rock, maybe they'd like to hear about the circumstances of that, of him, of how they come to live under there. And
well, my people came in on the headwaters of Elk River way back over 200 years ago and settled there. And at that time, the hills was full of Indians. They knew that. They knew that they were greatly outnumbered by the Indians, but they took that chance. And one day while my great-grandfather was hunting, the Indians attacked it and killed his brother and his wife and burnt their cabin. When he come home and found out what had happened, he told his wife she was expecting a baby most any time. He told her they'd have to leave because chances are the Indians would attack that night again, which of course that was nature of the Indians, and he knew that. But they didn't, fortunately they didn't. They didn't attack, but he told her they'd have to get what together they had to have and get out of there. And he knew about this rock, the overhanging rock. It was, at that time, it was about 20 feet deep back under it and about 40 feet long. And, of course, he knew about the rock, too. But it's about 3 miles from where they was. So he took her after night, and they had to wade the creek. It was a creek ran through the mountains past this rock, and they had to wade that creek. They had to follow the water because they couldn't travel on the land because the Indians could track them. He knew that. And he told her they'd have to stay in the water. They'd have to wade the creek. And part of the time, he had to carry her. He was, fortunately, he was a very, very husky man. He weighed over 200 pounds and was 6'2". And, they went to this rock, and hid out there. And fortunately, the Indians never did come back and never give them any more trouble. But anyway, they stayed there for quite some time. And shortly after they went to the rock, by they had a youngster. She had a baby, and but they still stayed under that rock and for quite some time before they walled it up. Finally, they walled it up and made a very, very comfortable place to stay. And since in late years, some North Carolina outfit got a hold of the timber in that area, and they've timbered it about three times in the last 50 or 60 years, and bulldozing and working around while that rock is washed and has filled in around a good bit to what it was then. The rock, you still can understand, you know, why that they'd pick a place like that. But I've often thought about it. What if such a thing would face people today? I don't know of anybody you could point to. We've got people which could do that and would do it. But just think about getting up in the morning, taking your rifle, and going out to get your breakfast before you had any breakfast. That rifle depended on whether you ate or didn't. And not knowing whether you'd come back and your wife and baby be alive or be there all cut up by the Indians. That's what they went through with. But they did it. And they outlasted the Indians. They was there longer than the Indians was. The Indians were gone a long time before they all died out. On our record, mine and Gary's record, was my picture standing under that rock, and I was playing the fiddle and playing Shelvin Rock, the tune that my great-grandfather wrote. That's what I was playing, standing under that rock.
Isn't it true that your great-grandfather was born under that rock, and his mother was a full-blooded Indian?
Yeah, she was.
So he was really a half Indian.
Yeah, that's
your great-grandfather.
Right. That's right.
I always thought kind of those tunes had a flavor to them that maybe came from someplace else other than white people.
The Indians had captured my great-grandfather when he was about 9 years old. He and a Hokum boy was together, and they strayed a little too far away, and the Indians spied him, and they just captured him, and they intended to kill him. They took him back to the Indian chief, and he said, kill him, and they killed a Hokum boy. And this young Indian girl was about the same age that they were. And she cried and carried on so about it that they told him my great-grandfather, they said they would spare him so many moons. They went by that, you know. And by the time that time expired, they had got to liking him because he knew all about the mountain rifle. And they had captured some rifles and had some rifles, and that was his life. If he told them a little bit, he didn't want to tell them anything. But he thought if he did, why, it might save his life, and it did. He began to tell them a little bit about the rifle, so they wasn't about to get rid of him. That's what they wanted to know. And they kept him. He was 18 years old when he escaped. And as they growed up, he and that girl, why, they fell in love, and he told her he had to go back and see if his people were still living, and if it was, well, he had to find them and let them know that he was still alive. They said they'd already give up ever seeing him again. They figured the Indians, they found a sign where the Indians had got them and the directions they went, but they couldn't follow him into the Indian camp. That'd be suicide. And so he told her he'd be back, and told her when he'd be back and where to meet him at. And he came back. His parents, when he went home, when they found out he was still alive, they didn't want him to go out of their sight. But he told them that he'd promised this girl he'd be back and get her, and they'd get married. And that's what he was going to do. And that's what he did do. And that's just what Gary was speaking of. She was my great-grandmother, and she was full-blooded Indian.
When I got to doing a little work on Ernie's record, working on the notes, I found a genealogist who had done a whole lot of work on the Carpenter family, and he said that the Ernie's people came from Wiltshire, England, in about the 1650s to Long Island, New York, and they stayed there until about 1750, when three brothers came to Jackson County, Virginia, down on the Cowpasture River, I think it was. And it's on the record down there of an Indian attack and somebody being captured. And we figured Ernie tells this story from a whole different perspective. His grandfather told him this. So, but it did kind of match up pretty well. They came from the Jackson County, Virginia, on up into West Virginia about 1782, and that's when that other Indian attack took place, when Ernie's great-great-grandfather went up and lived under that rock. But is it your grandfather that gave you most of this information?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was, why don't you talk about him a little bit, maybe?
My grandfather?
Yeah.
Well, he's quite a sportsman. He loved to fish and loved to hunt. And in his late years, well, that's about all he did. He was a small-like fella. He wasn't too big a man, but he was mighty what there was of him. And they gave him the nickname of Squirrely Bill. He could take a mountain rifle and go out in the woods and kill more squirrels than anybody else that wasn't anywhere. And he just killed so many squirrels and seemed to get them so easy. He was an excellent marksman. He had great eyes and did right up. Gosh, he did not. I suppose not more than 2 years before he died. He was at our place, and we had some birds around there. We used to call them yellowhammers. Maybe some of you fellows know what they are. They're something like a woodchuck. They're not probably quite as big, but they were building a nest in an old dead tree about. I expect a good 300 yards from the house. And we were sitting on the porch, and he was watching them birds over there. And he said, go get my rifle. He said, I haven't shot it for so long. He said, I need some practice. He said, I'll see if I still can shoot. I went and got him the rifle, and the old big mountain rifle, and drug it out there to him. And he loaded her up and went out in the yard and hunkered down, and pam, down come a yellowhammer. Just no problem. He handed it back to me and said, sir, by the way, he said, I can still shoot. I said, yeah, I think so. And he was a great fisherman. He caught a lot of fish. My father and his two brothers were sitting talking one day, and they said, Dad caught the biggest bass that ever was caught out of Elk River. And he had caught a catfish once that weighed 60 some pound, I forget what it was. And he said he caught the biggest catfish that ever was caught out of Elk River. And one of the other boys said, no. They said, down at Charleston, there was a fellow by the name of Crockett Beasley. He was a great hunter and a trapper. And he went out one morning, snowy, and the river was froze over with ice. And he saw an otter fighting something on the ice. And he could see this big object, and he knew he couldn't tell what that thing could be a fighting. So he went down and to where the otter was, and it was a catfish. He'd got it out of the ice had broke up there a little bit, and he'd got that thing out of the water, and had got it out on that ice somehow or other, and it weighed I think it was 65 or 67 pounds, somewhere along there. And my uncle stopped, my other uncle, when he said he caught the biggest catfish. My grandfather caught one on a trot line that was just a little short of that. And my other uncle said, nope, he said Crockett Beasley caught the biggest catfish ever was caught. My other uncle spoke up and said, no, he didn't. He took that catfish from the beaver, or the otter. Said the otter caught that. Said the otter caught that piece. Said, and I was right.
So. You want to play one of Squirrel Bill's tunes? You want to play one of Squirrel, your grandfather's tunes?
Well, let's see. I might play that old tune that we played at his paper ride. I should tell him about the bartender, or is that not?
I was wondering, you were talking about the Shelvin Rock, and the Shelvin Rock's on a place called Camp Run up off Laurel Creek there.
Yeah.
Maybe you ought to play that tune, Camp Run.
Here's a tune I call Camp Run. I patched it up, and I didn't know what to call it, and I just called it Camp Run. That's where the rocks are where my grandfather went.